Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the podcast where we explode!
No!
We don't explode. We're actually very measured.
Oh.
Calm. And professional.
I don't really have a sound effect for that. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic for The Rap. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a film critic. I write for /film.
Ooh.
And I don't have a nickname, but that's okay.
It is okay. And this week on Critically Acclaimed, it's actually a bit of a lean week for us. Usually we try to see as many films as humanly possible, but this last week, as you may have heard in some of our other podcasts, if you listen to all of them, we were sick. I had COVID, and then coincidentally, Whitney had COVID. Completely unrelated circumstances.
Completely unrelated.
Not in any way connected. Whatsoever. I'm sorry I probably gave you COVID.
You know what? I don't resent anything here.
We might have gotten it at the same screening or something. Like, these things happen, but it's probably got it from
look,
me.
We both tested negative. We're both on the other side of it.
Yeah, we're fine.
And now we get to find out what the long-term effects of this thing
are. We're vaccinated, though. It was reasonably mild for both of us. So we did the best we could.
I was vaccinated. I was also boosted. So my symptoms were incredibly mild. Yeah.
Thank you for the kind wishes, everybody who tweeted at us. And that means a lot. But we're fine. And we're going to get through.
But as a result, we weren't able to go to screenings this last week. So we've missed out on a lot of the things that are in theaters.
Especially things that were theatrical only, like Bullet Train. That's the number one movie of the weekend. Normally, we try to see the number one movie of the weekend no matter what. And we just couldn't this time. Sorry about that.
And an A24 film came out called Bodies, 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 which I really wanted to see and just wasn't able to see because I couldn't go to the screenings.
There were only theatrical screenings. Some places don't really do online screenings. Some places are more cool about sending off screeners. We only saw two films apiece. We saw Prey. We both saw the new film in the Predator series. Whitney saw a new film called They/Them.
That's right.
It's a horror movie on Peacock. And I saw a new film called I Love My Dad, starring Patton Oswalt. So we'll be reviewing those three, and we'll miss a couple of the big ones, but we'll try to catch up.
A bit of a light week, but we do want to provide you with something.
Indeed. And I think even though Bullet Train is number one at the box office, the only film I see people talking about this week is Prey.
Well, it's difficult to get a line because, you know, we all run in different circles. People talking about different stuff. There may be circles out there that are all about Bullet Train.
I'm not pretending that I have my finger on the pulse of every community, but in my own community, Prey has been dominating the conversation, so let's talk about Prey. Prey is a new film from Dan Trachtenberg, who previously directed the film 10 Cloverfield Lane, starring Mary Elizabeth Winstead and John Goodman.
It's pretty good. It's a survivalist horror movie where Mary Elizabeth Winstead is put in a survivalist bunker, an underground bomb shelter, with John Goodman and some other people. And John Goodman, he's the one who built the bunker. He's the one who has all the food. And
he claims they can't leave, but they have no way of knowing whether or not that's true.
There's a lot of suspicion as to whether or not he's telling the truth. And his... hitting things. I think his story is that there are space aliens.
Something to that effect.
There's something really extraordinary.
And people have the whole air outside is toxic and you die within minutes
if
you
melt if you breathe it. That's a pretty good movie.
And then the situation becomes so abusive and untenable that they have to. Mary Elizabeth Winstead has to weigh the possibility, is it more dangerous to go outside or is it more dangerous to stay inside? That is a movie that has grown on me over time. At the time, I really admired it, and I still think John Goodman should have been nominated for an Oscar for that movie. He's fantastic in that movie.
I mean, he's good in everything.
That's true, but if he was going to be nominated for anything, it would be that, The Big Lebowski, or Barton Fink.
Yeah.
Those are the three, if you ask me. Should have been nominated for all three. But I had an issue with the ending, and it's not so popular a movie. I feel comfortable just talking about the ending.
Yeah.
But I had an issue with the way that they handled a big reveal. And initially, I thought it kind of undermined the premise. And the more I think about it, the more I realize that the movie probably was focusing on a different theme that I was really focusing on. And it kind of does work, although I think maybe I would have liked it better the other way. But
there's a little bit of
a
deliberate bait and switch that was a little too effective.
Maybe.
There's this really bizarre symbolism at the end, which doesn't play so well.
More I think about it, though, the more I think it works better than I originally thought it did. So I am quite fond of it. I think he's very, very talented. And indeed, his next movie, it took him a few years, but his next movie is a film of the Predator series.
It's the seventh Predator movie, but don't worry about that. Because Prey is actually a far more effective film without prior knowledge of a Predator. There's a few visual references.
Mm-hmm.
But this film is good enough about communicating what a lot of the things that the Predator does means in this context.
Yeah.
Without you having to know what he did in a previous movie to know what's going on here.
And of course, it's a different Predator every single time, I think. Maybe Aliens versus Predator. I think there's like one holdover. But so the Predator movies are actually like mostly disconnected from each other. They're their own little stories. And the greatest compliment I can give... like a horror franchise sequel is that if this was the first film in the series, it would have spawned a franchise. It stands on its own. It's incredibly effective. It remembers what it's about. Mm. It tells that story really, really well. And it might help if you had seen some of the other movies, because there's a few distinct but not very important references to other stuff, and you might go like, "Oh, I get it."
Yeah.
But you don't need it. And if you'd never seen another Predator movie and the first Predator movie you saw was Prey, you would totally get it. And it would be fucking awesome.
I long ago lost my patience with sequels that assume that an audience going into a sequel...
Not only knows
everything about these previous movies, but cares very deeply about little details from previous movies.
Mm.
This is the Star Wars effect. Yeah. People watch Star Wars so many times that now they're making whole movies based on single lines of dialogue that were just said in a movie, but because people had watched these movies so many times, every detail...
Yeah. There's no incidental detail in anyone's life.
There's not every moment is a big moment.
Han Solo didn't just go out and buy a gun someday because he's a criminal and he needed one. Mm. It had to be given to him, and it's super important. And
yeah,
carry like the, every why, single
why
thing.
Why is the gun important?
It's every not. Single thing people wear, use, every single thing they've ever touched or interacted with has to have an important backstory to them that is alluded to in the past, and it drives me up the wall when Star Wars does this, because that's almost all it does now.
Yeah, and it's all just references to things that happened in previous movies.
I can handle it to a point. Like, once in a while, it's kind of cute. Like, oh, okay, that's cool. That tracks. That was from here.
But once in a while is fun.
Yeah.
Then it's
like fun. It's like an Easter egg. Like,
it's like a cute little reference for somebody. Like, there was a scene in The Force Awakens, where they're on... That's a lot of nostalgia stuff. It's like, we're going to use the same ship again. And there's a moment in where I feel like if there was only just this moment, it would have been fine, where John Boyega is digging through like a chest of stuff. Like, he's looking for something in a big chest of junk.
Yeah.
And he pulls out this little gray sphere and just sort of throws it aside.
Yeah.
And
that was Star a little Wars, training module yeah, that like, Luke it was, used
it's
in
this
episode
little,
four.
Yeah, this little floating thing that shot lasers. Yeah. If like, just that.
Yeah.
Just that moment just, had been included.
It's just putting around in a drawer somewhere, and it means nothing to John Boyega.
Yeah, so
and
he
we recognize
it aside,
real fast, like oh.
And yeah,
nope,
a moment's like, oh, that's cute, and that's all we want.
Yeah,
he's just that's all that's
rummaging
needed.
Through a junk drawer. That's all there is to it.
I feel like you can't do that with the Predator series, because the myth of the Predator is incredibly thin.
Yeah.
There's not a lot going on with the Predator. In fact,
the movie The Predator is the one that tried to add a lot of mythos to it, and that's a big part of the reason why that movie doesn't work, because every single time they try to explain the very thin concept... Here's the concept of the Predator. Alien species comes to Earth on the weekends once in a while to hunt. Much like someone might like take a weekend off from work and the family, go out with a couple of guys, put on orange vests, shoot a couple of defenseless animals, and go home. Mm. Predators, they have overpowered weaponry. They go to planets with nowhere near as much
technology.
People who really can't fight back very well, and then they take a couple of pot shots and they go home. And every single time, they pick the wrong guy. Then it turns into an Elmer Fudd situation where the Predator is Elmer Fudd and Arnold Schwarzenegger or Danny Glover or Adrian Brody.
Or Amber Midthunder in this one.
And they're Bugs Bunny. And they're like the rabbit who kills the hunter.
And the films are always very good about showing how dangerous they are, and they kill a lot of people.
There's
and
a lot
then,
of cool stuff.
And
I think Predator 1 is amazing.
Underestimate their prey.
Yeah, Predator 1 is amazing. Predator 2 is a fun monster movie. Predators is a fun monster movie.
I really like Predators.
It's pretty solid. I rewatched it recently. Yeah, there's some sort of hackneyed archetypal character writing, but
I don't mind that in that movie.
It's not the end of the world. It just would have been a little better if maybe they weren't a little bit more interesting, but
the only real sort of thematic run we have through these Predator movies, mm-hmm. and it's not really all that solid. Mm. The first one takes place in, I don't think they name what country it is.
If memory serves, it was supposed to be, I think in Predators, they actually, I think they say it was Guatemala.
But that's a retcon
because if memory serves,
it's a Central American nation.
Well, this is actually a fun little bit of trivia. If memory serves, there was one Central American country, a fictional one, that they used in a lot of different movies whenever they wanted to do like something in that area and they didn't want to piss anyone
Sengala
off.
Or whatever,
it was called Costa Verde.
Costa Verde.
Costa Verde was the country from Commando, and I'm pretty sure it's supposed to be the country in Predator as well, and it showed up in a couple other movies.
Costa Verde. Okay, so it's a nondescript, non-existent Central American
country. It's like Gotham City or Latveria. It sounds real enough, and we just move on.
The plot of the movie is, like, the manliest men possible, these army guys the original Predator, go into Costa Verde on a rescue mission, if I recall. Mm-hmm. And they are over-armed. They have way more bullets than they need for this mission. And it's very, very violent, and they fire a lot of bullets. It looks like a war zone. It's like they're actually, like, instigating a battle. And that's...
No, it's not Costa Verde. It's Val Verde.
I looked that up.
That's on me. That's 100%. I know I said that wrong in a recent podcast or something too.
All right.
It's called Val Verde. That's the fictional country. Apologies.
Incidentally, that'll be my adult film name. I will be Val Verde. The creature has like an invisibility cloak. Like it kind of move and you can kind of see it shimmering, but if it's hold still, you can't really see it. And it hunts people where there's violence already happening.
Mm.
That's the thing that's happening in the first Predator. And the second one, it's set in the near future in Los Angeles.
It's been like 1997. And the movie was in like 1991 or 92, so it wasn't even that far.
Yeah, and there's like a heat wave, and like in RoboCop, crime has just exploded. There's just out and out gang wars in the streets, and people are fighting. And that's where the Predator decides to hunt.
He decides to hunt in Los Angeles, and he takes out a bunch of like criminals with guns. Yeah.
The only comment I can really glean from that is crime has gotten so bad it's indistinguishable from war.
Yeah, which is not very deep, but it's fine.
But so that's why the Predator went there, I guess.
The first Predator is very, very. It's almost completely satirical in a lot of ways, in the way that it builds up all of the familiar macho action tropes of the era, stuff you would find in movies like Commando. And then undermines it because all the tough guys get killed by the Predator. I've said before, it's like a slasher movie where all the victims are jocks.
Yeah.
Which is totally fine. But the second movie doesn't have any meaningful commentary to it at all, other than like really baseline stuff. It's basically just a monster movie in Los Angeles. Mm. But I enjoyed the hell out of that movie. They actually make it really fun.
It's pretty over the top. Gary Busey plays
the CSI guy. And... like he's the guy who's tracking the alien. He knows what's going on.
There's some really wonderful interviews with Gary Busey that are completely unhinged on the set of Predator 2.
I'll bet,
where he talks about, like, well, why is this guy obsessed with the Predator? And he's talking about, well, they have, like, knowledge of the fabric of the universe, man. And, like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Nice.
Then many years passed.
Predator 2 didn't do great.
Yeah,
so
Predator
like
2
just...
It was kind of a bomb. It didn't get great reviews. It's been reassessed a little bit. It's fine. It's a completely watchable movie.
Predator is just one of those movies where the character is iconic, but they really had trouble cracking the movie series. And for years, Predator was mostly seen in comics and video games.
Yeah. Dark Horse Comics.
Yeah.
Their stock in trade was buying the comic book rights to known characters.
Yeah.
So there were RoboCop comics and Terminator comics, and they did all the Star Wars comics.
For a long time, Marvel
and
did.
They also had Alien.
Actually, first Marvel had them, then Dark Horse, then Marvel again.
Okay. But Dark Horse had them for a second.
Oh, for a long time,
And they also had Alien, based on the Ridley Scott movie, and they had Predator, based on the John McTiernan movie, and it was Dark Horse who first thought, hey, why don't we just start throwing these people together? So they were the ones who kind of conceived of Alien versus Predator, and the Alien versus Predator notion became so popular that they made movies out of that. Alien versus Predator was made by Paul W.S. Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
It's really stupid. It's fun if you're nine.
It's like it's a matinee kind of version.
It's PG-13. It's not as violent.
If Predator
nothing makes sense in the movie.
If Predator is John Milius's Conan the Barbarian. Uh-huh. Alien vs. Predator is Conan the Destroyer. Like, it's just cheaper and sillier, and it gets a lot of things wrong if you were paying attention. But I rewatched it recently. I used to hate that movie. I rewatched it recently, and there are things that drive me nuts about it, where it's just like, you really didn't have to rewrite the rules of the monsters to make this movie. You just kind of did it arbitrarily, and it's annoying because it's clearly fan service, so you're doing things that are distracting to fans, which is weird. But if you accept it as its own thing, it's almost a PG-13 movie. Like, it's violent. I think it still is an R, but it feels PG-13.
It has an R rating. If you look it up, it says, like, there's an R rating for slime. I remember that.
But, like, it feels less violent and, like, but it's a reasonably entertaining movie. It's just not very good.
It's pretty cheap.
It was a major step down for the Alien franchise. It was about plateau for Predator 2,
If you want to see, if all you want to see is those monsters fighting, the alien from Predator and the alien from Alien.
You'll get it.
Alien versus regular size alien, Predator versus queen alien.
You get to see the queen alien like running around. It's like the size of a T-Rex now, which I'm pretty sure is not how big that thing was. But
big, but yeah.
I don't think it was T-Rex size in Aliens, man. I feel like it was, but neat though. It's kind of cool.
And it takes place in like the... an Aztec pyramid in this. Anyway, it doesn't really.
I'm going to do something a little gauche. I'm going to read to you. I recently did an article.
You ranked them.
I ranked the Alien and Predator movies because there's a new one. And when Alien versus Predator came out, they just basically became intertwined. I'm going to read to you the listing I wrote for Alien versus Predator, and then the film that immediately followed it on my ranked list, Prometheus. In Alien vs. Predator, the aging head of the Weyland Corporation assembles an expert team to investigate a mysterious ancient structure containing evidence of aliens who interfered with human history, only to unleash monsters that kill them all. In the hands of director Paul W.S. Anderson, the story yields a ridiculous but reasonably entertaining monster movie where the plot makes no sense, the mythology makes no sense, and the characters make no sense. But at least the fights are cool.
And I see and where you're going with this.
For Prometheus. In Prometheus, the aging head of the Weyland Corporation assembles an expert team to investigate a mysterious ancient structure containing evidence of aliens who interfered with human history, only to unleash monsters that kill them all. In the hands of director Ridley Scott, that story yields a ridiculous but reasonably entertaining monster movie where the plot makes no sense, the mythology makes no sense, and the characters make no sense, but at least the production design is cool. It's weird similar those movies are.
During the production of Prometheus, from what I understand, and this is just hearsay, but somebody pointed out to Ridley Scott
that there were similarities.
Well, that he invented the character of Weyland, which was the name of the company that the original characters worked for.
It was actually Weyland Yutani.
They didn't say that until Alien Resurrection.
Wait, what? Are you sure?
I am positive. That might have been something established in, like, extra canonical stuff.
Like, maybe it was like in the director's guy. I could have sworn.
But they didn't say Weyland Yutani in a movie until Alien Resurrection.
I believe you. All right. But in any case, initially it was the Weyland Corporation. And so, yeah. So he put Mr. Weyland in Prometheus, played by Guy Pearce. But Paul W.S. Anderson had already done that. He'd be played by Lance Henriksen from Aliens. Fun.
So you kind of ignore the Alien versus Predator movies when it comes to the canon in either.
Well, Ridley Scott ignored almost all the canon, except for the first Alien anyway, so it's like fine. It's just funny. Anyway,
I really dig Prometheus.
I know you do. Alien versus Predator was followed by Aliens versus Predator, which sucks.
Alien... The full title of the movie was AVP... : Alien versus Predator.
That was the original
sequel.
Predator
was AVPR : Aliens versus Predator - Requiem. which is a big old mouthful, and it's an even worse movie. It has terrible production design. It's the cinematography
really that kills it, because it's so darkly lit you can't see what's going on.
Like, even if you turn the brightness up on your television, you can't see what's going on in that movie. And it takes place on modern day Earth. It's the only movie in the Alien series to do that, and it's not very interesting. It's just running around a small town with these creatures.
What if the monsters ended up in
version of things?
It actually feels like what they're trying to do is like an Amblin movie, where here's like a small town where everyone has their own storylines, and then monsters attack. None of the characters are interesting. None of the subplots are interesting. None of the dialogue is interesting. There's a couple of really fucked up things that happen in it.
Mm.
There's a scene in a hospital, which is easily the most disgusting thing that happens in either an Alien or a Predator movie. Mm. Like, it is so fucked up that I know people who are like really into gory movies who went, you know what? That's too far. That's not even fun anymore. That's just fucked up. But you can't even like enjoy it because you can't see it. It's just really hard to look at. It's a very, you know, there's a lot of movies that are bad, not because they're incompetent, but just because they don't do good things. This one's actually incompetent. Like, it's almost it's refreshing like to be able to point to it. It's like, you can't see it.
No.
Like, it's not, and it doesn't feel like a clever, like, mysterious choice. Like, they're all in shadow. It's like the end of Alien where you can't even see the alien in the background because it's in shadow. That's an intentional choice. This feels like it's just too dark. I don't know why.
And we're talking about it because it's a problem. It actually affects the movie.
Yeah.
Then a couple years later, a filmmaker named Nimrod Antal, who I actually made Predators, plural.
Based on a story that was co-written by Robert Rodriguez.
Okay.
And the
premise of that one is a bunch of humans are dropped off on a planet that's not Earth.
Yeah.
They're basically
brought to a game preserve.
Yeah. The film opens with Adrian Brody coming to out of consciousness while he's plummeting from the sky.
Yeah.
Pretty fun opening. And
he meets a bunch of cast. We've got Walton Goggins, Mahershala Ali before he won a bunch of Oscars, Alice Braga, Topher Grace, Danny Trejo, Lawrence Fishburne. Cool cast.
And as they communicate, we learn that they're all like dangerous criminals back on Earth. And they were all incarcerated.
Yeah.
And they have been scooped up presumably by the Predators to be hunted on this planet.
Yeah.
And there are multiple Predators and they have a Predator dog. Yeah. And that's a pretty fun premise.
It's a very fun premise.
Because the heroes are not bad guys.
It's very simplistic, a little slightly to a fault. It's too big a cast for the characters to all stand out.
Yeah.
I think that's a problem.
Well, I also think you need a lot of human meat to slice up. So yeah. I'm okay with that.
I also think they kind of did themselves, like, I realize I'm sure it's a budgetary issue, but I always felt like it was a bit of a missed opportunity to do a Predator story with people on an alien planet that just happens to look like a jungle you'd find here on Earth. Like, can we maybe have some, like,
purple alien plants
or like some weird other animals or whatever like that could be dangerous. There's like, can we have fun with that? Because it feels like you're not having fun with that.
It's a really similar movie called Riddick with Vin Diesel, which did that. It takes place on an alien world and it looks like an alien world. Like, they actually went out of their way to make things look a little strange.
Yeah.
He befriends a dog, but it's like an alien dog.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Then a few years thereafter, Shane Black, who acted in the first movie and was hired as an actor specifically so he could do brush up on set.
Yeah, like, you're here. You want to just take a crack at some of the dialogue? That's allegedly what happened.
This is something that Shane Black has alleged. So he's said this out loud.
I know.
And he wrote and directed this one. And I like Shane Black.
He co-wrote it with Fred Decker, who Shane Black had written the screenplay for the Monster Squad. Fred Decker directed that one, so they just kind of flipped duties.
Shane Black and Fred Decker wrote it. Shane Black directed it, and it is the piss.
It's so bad.
It's bad, and I don't really know what he was trying to go for. Everybody's a little too flip and funny.
Mm-hmm.
The ostensible group of heroes is mental patients.
A bunch of soldiers with PTSD in various ways. Thomas Jane, I think, has Tourette's, if memory serves.
Thomas Jane is in it. Keegan-Michael Key is in it. And
I think it's Trevante Rhodes in that one, I think. I could be wrong.
Sure.
Really good cast again. But like,
Olivia Munn played the professor. Mm-hmm. And
Jake Busey got to play Gary Busey's son, which is cute.
Because he is. Isn't that funny?
Isn't that cute? Yeah.
The... not only is it horribly written, not only are they trying to expand the mythology, like the predators are preparing for a super predator of some kind.
What happens, and the plot of that is the predators only come to Earth when it's hot, so as we've been like doing climate change, predators have been coming more, and maybe the predators are responsible for it a little bit. And they're also using human DNA to like, they're trying to get the best fighting DNA so that they can make themselves super predators with human DNA. And they think maybe they finally cracked the way to become the ultimate super predators by taking DNA from an autistic kid, which is really messed up in a lot of different ways. They really didn't think that shit through.
The movie thinks that trauma gives you superpowers and that autism is a superpower as well.
The movie thinks that autism gives you superpowers and trauma makes you weak, and at the end of the movie, the solution to everyone's problem, everyone with widely varying mental health issues, the solution is, quote, man up.
Fuck you, movie.
Like, seriously, it's really fucked up.
There's a way, and the first Predator could play, like, a satire of those, like, big burly men, and if he were trying to satirize something, like, clearly trying to satirize something, maybe that film would have worked.
And but, maybe that's what they were getting at. It's my understanding there was quite a bit of studio interference on that, like, the ending changed a few times. There's a twist ending, sort of, at the end, which is stupid.
It's entirely possible that he was trying to do that again, and it just didn't read, but
maybe.
What we got is a terrible film.
Yeah, and the action isn't that good. It's really silly and doesn't work.
The Predator. And now we are back to forgetting about Predators. Now we're just going with Prey. And
good idea for a title, by the way. Makes it seem new
That should have been the first title. It should have been Predator 2. It should have been called Prey. But,
That makes sense. Or Time to Bleed. Because that line, ain't got time to bleed.
Ain't got time to bleed.
That would have been good.
Going back very briefly to the Dark Horse Comics era, they explored a lot of fun and interesting things in Dark Horse Comics throughout the 90s.
Yeah.
And one of their gimmicks with the Predator was just set it in different historical periods.
Yeah.
Here's one where Predator fights pirates on a pirate ship.
Cool.
Here's one where Predator fights ancient Egyptians, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And
they've been coming for a while. Let's have them show other times they showed up. Neat.
And, you know, people of different cultures with different levels of technology, how do they deal with this super monster that's beamed down from the sky?
Yeah, it's episodic, but it's fun.
And so they took that idea from Dark Horse Comics and just did a movie of it. And so this is a movie set in Comanche country in 1719. I looked up a tiny bit of history, and evidently this was a time of great expansion for the Comanche Nation.
Okay.
The main character, her name is Nauru. She's played by an actress named Amber Midthunder. She was in the TV show Legion and some other things. She's been acting since she was like 4.
Yeah.
She is an expert tracker, and she's a very good hunter, and she's, because of sexism in the tribe, she's not allowed to go with the men to go hunting.
Well, she wants to go on basically a rite of passage, which is not just going on a hunt, but to hunt something that is also hunting you. Which would normally be some sort of predator, some sort of carnivore.
I think there's like pumas around.
Well, there's definitely a big mountain lion somewhere in the movie. There's wolves in the area, and there's bears. So it's not inconceivable that any one of those might have done the trick. But
she's quite handy with a tomahawk. I love how slow this movie is at the start, where it establishes all the characters and the setting and the place and the pace. It's not impatient to get to the monster stuff.
No, in fact, that's one of the, and that's something that I think they actually paid attention to in the original Predator, is aside from like a couple of little things, like you see the spaceship at the beginning, and then we lose track of it for a while because it's not important yet. We're just playing fair, so that when the Predator shows up, you're like, oh, okay, you played fair. But like, the cool thing about like a lot of like horror and sci-fi movies is that the characters exist in a world where they don't know about this stuff yet. But if you introduce, like, the vampire or the alien or whatever in the first 5 minutes and the characters interact with it too quickly, then it just feels like it's part of their status quo, and it doesn't really feel as special all the time. Whereas in something like Predator, they're halfway through a mission before they find out aliens are real. It's weird. From Dusk Till Dawn is another example where it's like,
all of a sudden they're a vampire.
It's a kidnapping movie for like 45 fucking minutes, and then they're vampires, and it comes as much of a shock to the audience. Even if you knew what it was going in, you just kind of got used to the vibe of it by now. It's as weird to you as it is to the characters. And so here is a story that if the Predator never showed up, would have been perfectly interesting. There are interesting characters in this group of people. Here's someone who's on an interesting journey. She's got a lot of conflict, there's a lot of obstacles in her path, and she really wants to prove herself. And so when an opportunity comes to join a hunt for a mountain lion that had dragged away one of the one of the young men.
They have to find the young man and see if he's alive.
She tags along, and then gradually she becomes aware that there is a demon, or as we know in the audience, an alien, in their midst, who is on a hunting expedition. And she starts figuring it out very slowly, because it's not easy to figure it out unless you've seen the other movies. Take some context.
The design of the alien in the previous movies has always been a little bit thick and clunky.
Mm-hmm.
Especially
in the Anderson movies. They're chunky.
Yeah, they clearly put somebody in like a latex suit or like a silicone suit.
I always preferred the lithe version of them in Predator 1 and 2.
In Predators, I think they made them look a little bit more like aliens, like they actually look like beings. And this bizarre, one, I think, is best. Not only is it like they're using like CGI to sort of slim it out, but they're also using certain camera angles to make it look bigger.
Oh, yeah.
Played like a big basketball player guy who's like 6'7" or something, but they made
his name is Dane DeLiegro.
Dane DeLiegro plays the monster, but they shot him in such a way where he looks like he's 9 feet tall.
Yeah,
and we get to see him. They usually travel around with these scanning masks, and so we get to see them take the masks off, and they actually like altered the face so it looks even more alien than it did in the past.
Well, one thing, and this is something that maybe the Predator and the Alien versus Predator movies aren't canon, because I'm not entirely sure. But nothing in this movie contradicts Predator 1, Predator 2, or Predators.
Or any of them.
Well, nothing, certainly not those three. And I feel like, and I would have to like double check this, like the Predator that we saw is actually one of like the bigger, meaner Predators that we first met in the movie Predators.
Oh, okay.
Like, it just looks a little different from the one from the original two movies.
I just see that as we have an opportunity to redesign it, so we're going to do that.
If you're really paying attention, it's kind of fun. That's all.
There are occasional shots of this alien creature stalking around the countryside, and it, is clearly looking for the most dangerous game.
Yeah. It fights a wolf, it fights a bear.
At first it fights a snake, and the snake is made short work of, and then it fights a wolf, and then eventually Amber Midthunder sees the creature fight a bear. It's like, and that's like, you know what? I saw something and it's really fucked up. It killed a bear.
Yeah, but it's like its bare hands too.
Can
like,
we do Jesus. Something? And
nobody believes her at first.
Nobody believes her at first. The usual kind of cliche things that she has to sort of train on her own and face off. And then, of course, she gets help from, I think it's her brother.
It's her brother. What happens is...
Played by an actor named Dakota Beavers, and he's really good.
He's so good. Like, they're great leads.
Mm.
I want to see more from both of them.
They have
really
like a good,
great.
Believable... What I like about their relationship between the brother and sister characters is it's really antagonistic, but they also have each other's backs.
Yeah, in a believable way. Yeah, we're just competitive.
I'm gonna give you a lot of crap, but when I say something, I'm actually gonna listen and believe you and not do that annoying movie thing where nobody ever believes the hero.
No.
He actually has her back. I saw a big footprint over there. That's just a bear. No, look again. Okay, you're right. Okay, something weird's going on here, and I believe you now. Moments like that.
And they're really wonderful together. And then the story escalates, and then eventually a whole bunch of people get slaughtered, and there's a lot of really cool fighting stuff.
Eventually some French trappers, some colonialists get involved, and this is 1719, so there's a little bit of, the assholes have arrived.
Yeah, well, there's a moment that harkens back to that bit in Dances with Wolves, where they run into a field of buffalo, and they've been like, they've been skinned, but they've also been wasted. Like, they didn't use the meat or anything. It was just an entirely wasteful way to approach the animals and the environment. And so we run into that, and for a second we think it's the Predator, but then we remember, there are trappers in the area. And there's some larger context going on. But I think one of the things that works best about this movie is, although there's some subtext, and but it's basically just stripped down. It's actually like an extremely efficient narrative.
It's just a good monster movie.
It's a very good monster movie with rock solid characters in it. It's well written, but it's not overwritten. It's actually like there's hardly any dialogue unless there needs to be.
Do that cutesy thing where you have to know what happened in the previous movies.
No, like there's a couple of moments where it might help, but you don't need it.
Yeah, there's some callbacks, but they function in this story just as well as they did.
If this was your first Predator movie, A, I think you're going to love it. B, I think you're going to want to watch a couple more.
In fact, if you haven't seen any Predator movies, start with this one.
It's not a bad start.
I mean, chronologically, it's the first anyway.
But it really does work, and you'll pick up on a couple of things that this is like making reference to later, and you'll go, I get it now. But like, it really works really, really nice.
The idea of transposing a science fiction premise, very simple thing, into a moment in the distant past is a pretty simple idea that I feel like should just employ more.
It cuts through a lot of the clutter. You don't have to have people talking about, like, oh, I saw something like this in a movie once. And you don't have to have shit like, oh, no, my cell phone doesn't work. None of those little distractions are in the narrative. It's all immediate.
Just go back.
People get to discover things and have wonder about it for the first time.
There's a really wonderful promise in The Terminator, the James Cameron movie. There's time travel in that story. Robots come from the future to kill the mother of the resistance fighter that's giving them trouble in the future.
Yeah.
Okay, it didn't work when you went back to 1984. Go back to 1964. Then go back to 1864. Then go back to 50 AD. You know, keep on going.
In Genesis, they said they did that.
Let's watch that movie. I don't want to watch Genesis.
Right, no, it's cool.
Genesis is a piece of crap.
I think there was like a Sarah Connor Chronicles episode. We found out some Terminators ended up going back to like Prohibition era gangster times or something like that.
That should have been the film series. Each movie should have been like a generation prior to the one.
And frankly, I really do like this. I think it's much more interesting for like to not have this. Scream was a big deal when it came out because it was like the first movie in which people found themselves in like a movie situation and constantly talked about how they feels like they're in a movie. Which it would, if that happened in real life, you would probably reference
this is a lot like a horror movie,
and we would probably
these ones in particular,
and we wouldn't make note of it because it would it's our filter now. But that gets really tiresome after a while, especially when you consider how few movies have anything to add by having those conversations. So I'm tired of all of that. It's fine, but it doesn't make it interesting. It's just part of the fabric now. This movie takes all of that away. We don't get any of that. The audience is a little ahead of it because we're aware of the franchise and because we see a few scenes that the character doesn't, like the alien ship dropping off the Predator, that kind of thing. But we're not that far ahead of anybody, especially if you haven't seen it before. It all totally works. It's a really, really good way to handle it. The craft of this movie is really impeccable. It is really attractively photographed. It looks as good as any Western I've seen in a really long time. And I'm particular, I don't usually single this out when I talk about a movie because too often I think it's does its job fine, but it isn't worth it. Sarah Schachner's score is great. I love that score. Especially interesting considering Predator already has a kind of iconic score. Alan Silvestri's score for the original Predator is great.
It's recognizable, anyway. It's very
recognizable. It tells the story great. It's very memorable. It's been repeated multiple times throughout the franchise. It's highly effective. It's wonderful. And Sarah Schachner is clearly not doing that. It sounds a little bit more like more Western-y type things. I mean, more like modern Western-y type things or colonial films. You know, more along the lines of something like The Patriot or Last of the Mohicans. It's a great adventure score, but it's also adaptable enough that it can feel like a horror score when it needs to. It's really good, and it's one of those things where I'm just like, God, I hope... Because this debuted on Hulu, I don't know what the rules are. I hope it's eligible for an Oscar, because that score deserves a nomination. I love that score.
I don't know how it works with streaming. A lot of people are up in arms that this wasn't released theatrically. I'm getting a little less concerned about that these days. Just to see it how you see it.
If the only reason a movie has extra prestige is because it was in a theater, I think that's on you. Give it as much prestige as you want, as it deserves, and talk about it as if it has clout and credibility, then it does. It doesn't matter where you saw it first.
I value the theatrical experience. I like seeing things on a big screen, but I also openly acknowledge that the bulk of movies I've seen just in my life in general have been at home. And a lot of the greatest movies I've ever seen I saw on a VHS cassette for the first time. So I'm not getting too precious about the theatrical experience, but I think if you have an opportunity to see something in a theater, definitely see it. Mm-hmm. It's worth seeing at home. It is worth seeing in a theater.
And this would be a cool theatrical experience.
Yeah, and it would have, but because it's not available theatrically, mm-hmm. I'm not going to get angry about that.
No.
If you have a subscription to Hulu, which is where it's available, then you can watch it on Hulu.
In fact, I'm pretty zen about this one, actually, because the simple fact is, Predator has been struggling to find an audience in theaters since the first one. Like, the first one was a hit. Predator 2 did okay, but you notice there wasn't a follow-up right away.
The next big hit was Alien versus Predator, and
which was still not huge. It's actually, like, one of the lower-grossing Alien movies.
Actually, I don't think that's true. I think when you go to just sort of, like, unadjusted for inflation, Alien versus Predator is the highest grossing in both series combined.
Yes. I'm looking this up. Hang on.
Yeah, I'm fairly certain that's true. Correct me if I'm not. I think Alien versus Predator was actually this huge hit. A fun little bit of trivia about Alien versus Predator is Sigourney Weaver was looking at a script that was written by James Cameron, and Ridley Scott was interested in directing, and they were going to get Sigourney Weaver back. It was like this sort of like magical alchemy between Alien and Aliens.
Mm.
And they decided, it times out in just the right way that Freddy versus Jason had come out in 2003, and that had made so much money that they decided, no, we're not going to do the Ridley Scott James Cameron Alien. We're going to do Alien versus Predator instead.
No.
And that one made a lot of money.
It did okay. Here's what, for the sake of posterity, not that it's super important, but. I'm looking at thenumbers.com, the-numbers, which is the best site since Box Office Mojo changed the way it works and isn't very good anymore. So it looks like at the worldwide box office, the highest grossing film in the Alien franchise, leaving Predator out of it, is not adjusted for inflation, is Prometheus with $402 million. Good, not incredible by today's standards. Nowadays, less than 500 is not considered like, oh my god, we have to build a giant franchise out of it. Especially considering how much money they spend on these things. So after that, the next biggest one was Alien Covenant with $238 million.
Oh gosh, all right. I guess the newer ones higher.
But again, if you adjusted for inflation, a lot of the other ones would be more successful. Then after that, it's the original Alien. Followed very closely by Aliens. Like, they're within, like, 1.5 million of each other. Okay. Followed by... The next on the list is Alien vs. Predator.
Oh, I guess so.
With $172 million. Right. Followed reasonably closely by Alien Resurrection and Alien 3. And then the lowest grossing one in the series is Alien vs. Predator Requiem. So
it's also the worst one. But
in any case, my point is this: the Predator movies were never as big hits, even as the Alien movies. The Predator wasn't that long ago, and nobody really cared for it. So the franchise is a little radioactive right now. People aren't super excited about it. So if you'd put Prey in theaters right now, people who saw it would love it. But how many people would run to see it? Yeah. Whereas putting it on Hulu, where people have access to it immediately, I think is actually probably better for it in the long term.
Getting people talking about it.
People can see it right away. Mm. They don't have to put an additional investment in order to give it a chance in case they were, like, gun-shy because the last couple of them weren't good. And then they're going to watch it, they're going to love it, and then next time, now that we've got, like, the cred back, if they want to do a follow-up to Prey, or if they want to put another time period or something, then it's probably... I think it's actually probably a smarter move.
Yeah.
But that's business, and I don't care as much about that. What I do care about is that Prey is really good. I love this movie. I watched it again. There's
watched it twice.
Michelle hadn't seen it when I watched it, so Michelle was curious about it. So we watched it, and then we watched the Comanche dub.
Oh, cool!
There's not a lot of dialogue in the movie, and some of it in the original is in Comanche, but for the sake of mainstream audiences, most of the dialogue was in English. And so what happened was they redubbed some of the scenes that were filmed in English in Comanche, and you can tell the sync is off, but it's reasonably well done.
From what I understand, with the original actors, they got the original actors back.
Yeah, it plays great. If you watch them back-to-back, you'll notice that the subtitles are like... ever so slightly different, and I wonder if that's just a sort of a translation thing. Like, different languages have different words and different uses for terminology. But it's basically the same. It's the same story, certainly. And the Comanche dub is awesome, so I would recommend seeing it if you can. Yeah.
I'm not aware enough to sort of point out some of, like, errors that the filmmakers had made. Evidently, the person they hired as, like, sort of their combat consultant.
It was the archery instructor.
Archery, yeah.
Yeah, like, apparently the archery instructor just made shit up and didn't actually follow the...
whatever.
Yeah, that sucks, but what are you going to do?
Amber Midthunder is not Comanche, she's Sioux. Oh, you know, they hired a First Nation actor, so great.
Which is pretty good, but it would have been cool, but, like, you know, that doesn't ruin the movie, I think. Is it worth pointing out? Sure. Does it ruin the movie? I don't think it ruins it at all. I think the movie is still fucking great.
Yeah.
And I love this movie, and I hope you see it if you haven't already, because it's just that good.
It's pretty terrific.
Yeah. Tell me about the other horror movie that we saw this week.
Mm-hmm.
Is They/Them also terrific?
Mm-hmm.
I love that noise.
They/Them.
Wouldn't it be great if the Predator made that noise? He's just wandering around the woods going, like Eddie Deason, like,
I don't want to be in this movie. They/Them is bad.
Oh, no.
This is written and directed by John Logan.
Yeah.
Who is a celebrity screenwriter in Hollywood.
Oscar nominated. I don't think he won, but he was Oscar nominated. Let me look at John Logan's career, by the way.
He has been nominated three times.
Three fucking Oscars.
He wrote the screenplays for Gladiator, The Aviator, and Hugo.
In addition to Alien Covenant, bringing it back around, Skyfall.
He wrote Any Given Sunday. Mm-hmm. Star Trek Nemesis was his screenplay.
He wrote The Last Samurai.
Sweeney Todd. Rango, a great movie.
He wrote RKO 281, the story about the making of Citizen Kane. Pretty good, actually.
I believe this is his first film as a director. And, He has a really great talent for making these really interesting, complex, like The Aviator and Hugo, these interesting characters and these really elaborate setups.
Yeah.
While he was producing a recent documentary film on gay conversion camps, that is usually religious-run institutions where cruel parents will send their queer children to be made to behave in a heterosexual fashion.
Yeah, to try to reprogram them to behave in a way that the parents will approve of.
If you look at a lot of the language of these gay conversion camps, they don't say anywhere in the literature, we'll make your kids straight.
But that's what they're saying.
What they're saying is, we'll make them behave straight. You're still gay, but they'll never talk about it and they'll behave in a straight fashion. That's the goal of these camps. They are cruel and unusual.
Yep.
They still exist.
Yep.
They are sadistic and evil.
Yeah.
And John Logan learned a lot about these camps while producing the documentary film. Let me look up the name of the film that he produced. It was just called, like...
I got it here. Is it We're Not Here?
No, it's just called, like, the Institution. I had some really...
I'll look it up. You keep going. Because I didn't see this one, so you're going to have to tell me about it.
So he had the idea to set a slasher at a gay conversion camp. Fun idea.
Mm.
Because you want to see those people get murdered in a slasher movie. So the movie opens with a bunch of kids coming to this camp, and Kevin Bacon plays the head of this camp, and he starts the film with this very, very velvet talking kind of speech. You're here, and if anybody says that God hates gay people, they're bigots, and I'm not going to talk about God anymore. We're just going to find who you are, what your truth is, and you're going to live it. And it actually sounds very like, oh, wait, this actually is not a gay conversion camp. He's actually going to reaffirm all of these people. And then the big trouble comes where Kevin Bacon divides the kids into the boys' camp and the girls' camp, and the main character of the piece, Jordan, is non-binary.
Mm.
And they're not comfortable with going to the boys' or the girls' camp. And they say, don't you have any gender-free cabins? And they say, no, Jordan... just arbitrarily, I'm sending you to the boys' camp.
Yeah.
It's like, and we're going to refer to you, and you're going to have he pronouns now.
Mm.
And Jordan's like, that's bullshit. Jordan is the only one who like says it out loud, like from the start. So it's like, this is bullshit. This camp is bullshit.
It looks like the documentary is called Pray Away.
Pray Away.
And it looks like it was more of a Jason Blum's inspiration than Logan's. But yeah, anyway.
All right. And a frustratingly long amount of time in this movie is spent with these characters that we don't really explore that much. We get to know about their gender and their sexuality, and that's kind of where it stops. It resembles one of those really cheap queer films from the 1990s, where there was a big explosion of queer films in the 90s and the indie scene, and a lot of them were quite bad because they assumed that queerness was the only character trait that a lot of these characters had.
Yeah, by simply portraying characters who are queer, we've done enough work.
Yeah, like that's what their queerness is the only thing that made them interesting, and they didn't have any lives beyond that.
Yeah.
So every conversation they have is about the camp or about queerness. It's not about them as a person.
Right.
One of the counselors is played by Anna Chlumsky, and it's always nice to see her.
Yeah, she's great.
She was a child actress. She retired for a bit and then came back as an adult.
It's probably best known as the star of the My Girl movies.
Yeah, she was the girl in the My Girl movies back in the 90s, in like, it's like 92.
Early 90s.
Maybe, because movies came out. Never saw the My Girl movies.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, of course, there's a mass killer stalking about.
Naturally.
And
because that's the premise. There's a lot of summer. There's a lot of slash movies that are about a killer at a summer camp.
Killer at a summer camp.
This is a particular kind of summer camp. It makes sense. You know, on
paper, all of this is fine.
Yeah.
And of course, it's revealed that it's not enough to have these people running a conversion camp. That is, I suppose, not communicating enough that they're evil.
They have to do something more sinister.
They also
have
to do, like, evil, sinister things, like sending people out, like, kids after other kids to deliberately seduce them and then use, like, shock therapy and, like, and it looks like a torture chamber. Like, they don't need to have cartoon evil. It's already evil enough.
But yeah.
Also, John Logan, have you seen slasher movies?
That's not a great question to have to ask a director of a horror movie.
Do you know how these things are supposed to function?
What is
also, have you seen how fucking gay slasher movies are already? Have you seen Sleepaway Camp, for God's sake?
Well, yes, okay.
But there's a lot of sexuality and queerness in slasher movies already.
Yeah.
And he took it out for the movie that's ostensibly about sexuality and queerness.
Okay. That sucks.
Fear Street 1978 is way better about its queerness.
That's a really good summer camp slasher movie. I love that movie.
All three of the, I guess technically four of the Fear Street movies are great.
Because the third one's kind of two movies. It's an amazing series, though.
I wish they'd released it as two movies. But there's 1994, 1978,
1666,
and then at the end of 1666, there's like an hour long film where it's 94 part two.
Yeah,
they should have released them as four movies.
Whatever, I don't care. They're so good.
But John Logan whiffs everything. Okay. He whiffs the characters.
Uh-huh.
He whiffs any commentary. Like, what's the commentary here? It's supposed to be a revenge fantasy, right?
Yeah.
Queer audiences are going to watch this and take a dark glee in watching gay conversion camp rulers getting cut up.
A lot of horror movies operate on a level of exaggerated, but still morality, where things are kind of oversimplified. You know, you're evil, but what you do that would normally be considered immoral and ethical has been exaggerated to the point where you're a supervillain who murders people in their dreams or whatever. Yeah. And so it makes sense to just take strong stances in a straightforward horror movie.
Mm.
And it sounds like he took that away.
Yeah, well, and here's another frustrating thing. So they're careful to sort of run a gamut of gender and sexuality. There's a trans character, there's a non-binary character, there's a gay boy, there's a lesbian, there's a bisexual girl, and he treats...
Asexual?
Pardon?
Asexual?
There's no asexuals. I guess, if you're asexual, your parents aren't going to send you to a conversion camp.
Well, I don't know what the rules are, but, like, it's, in any case, just saying.
Yeah, not, I appreciate, though, that John Logan is trying to run the gamut of representation.
Sure.
A non-binary main character is
great.
Kind of a coup.
No, we need more of that,
Like, openly non-binary character.
Yeah.
Played by a non-binary performer.
Great.
Let me look up the performer's name. Who plays the character of Jordan?
Jordan. Theo Germain.
Theo Germain.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're great. Mm. So I appreciate what he's trying to do there. But there's a scene partway through the movie where... it's a terrible scene. Where all of the kids are together in a cabin and they're trying to bond. And they all bond over a pop song. And they all know the lyrics to this pop. I think that's a Lady Gaga song.
Okay. Is it Born This Way?
It's not Born This Way.
Okay.
Or maybe it's Katy Perry. I'm not up on my pop music. The point is, this is like... It's a queer anthem.
Yeah.
And they all know the lyrics.
Okay.
Which means John Logan's a gay man. But in this movie, queerness is this frustrating monolith.
Yeah.
Where all queer people kind of come at life the same way. So he's trying to have this wide gamut of experiences and genders and sexualities and have these people have, their own backstories that they're sort of bringing to this. She's mm-hmm. from the suburbs, and she's concerned about her parents. This person's going to be kicked out of the house. This person just wants to get, they're all trying, he's trying to really texture it a little bit, but then he doesn't do it. And he makes them all kind of behave kind of the same. They have these really flaccid love stories that are not interesting to watch.
Okay, here's what you're not telling me about. Tell me about the kills. It's a slasher movie, right?
What kills? He doesn't film them in an interesting way. It's the usual, we see an axe rise, and then we see a splatter of blood on the wall. It's not even like that's gory or interesting. You're not going to see somebody like impaled on a weather vane or something fun.
It's a bit ghoulish, but one of the things that we go to a slasher movie for is
interesting ways to watch people die.
Because slashers are formulaic. There's only so many things that we ask of them. So they're doing the same basic rigmarole over and over again. And there's only like so many spaces for genuine ingenuity. And one of those spaces is, we don't care how you kill them, so you can be creative there. You can do weird, exciting, interesting things. You can film it in an interesting way. You can come up with like, oh, I've never seen someone killed by that power tool before. Like, something. That's where even a bad slasher movie can have good kills. And you'd be like, oh, you know what? Every once in a while, I did something kind of scary, so cool, right? Yeah. And like, you can give it a pass.
Hmm.
No?
No.
Oh, fuck. No.
Like, shove a squirrel down someone's throat. I don't care. Do something fun and interesting. No, there's nothing fun and interesting.
We're not putting that on a shirt, by the way. Shove a squirrel down someone's throat. We're not doing that.
it's not good commentary.
Oh, God.
It's not interesting characters. It's terrible slasher movie. It's not a good mystery. There's not good gore. Kevin Bacon's okay, I guess, just because he's a good actor.
Oh, I mean, it's kind of fun to see Kevin Bacon back in, like, a summer camp horror movie, because he got his start in Friday the 13th. Yeah.
I feel like John Logan had never seen a slasher movie before. Like, he knew what it was from a book. So he doesn't know how to make I can't tell if he's trying to be campy with it, or if he's trying to be really serious about it. He just sort of goes all over the place, and at the end of the day, just everything sucks. So... I would recommend instead watch Sleepaway Camp. Watch any slasher.
Sleepaway Camp is really fucked up, by the way. Not everyone appreciates it, but it's an interesting film.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're gonna have seen something interesting. Something to talk about afterwards.
Watch Strip to Kill. Strip to Kill is a good movie.
There you go.
A lot of queerness in it.
Let's see.
Watch But I'm a Cheerleader, which is another film about.
I was
a gay
gonna bring this
camp.
Up. It's about a young woman played by Natasha Lyonne. She's a teenager. Everyone tells her she's queer. She doesn't even realize it yet. She doesn't realize she's queer until she goes to conversion camp and falls in love with Clea DuVall, as anyone would. That movie's great. I love that movie.
Jamie Babbitt is the director of that one.
Yeah.
And she's a playful director. I like Jamie Babbitt.
No, it's a fun film.
But that one, like, Jamie Babbitt went like full John Waters. Everything's really colorful and pink and campy and over the top. And
It fits. It makes the material more palpable than it would have been otherwise.
The villain is played by Kathy Moriarty, is just chewing scenery. She's so wonderful. That's a really good movie. Yeah. And it actually has a point of view about queerness.
Yeah.
It's just gayer in general.
It manages to be fiercely critical while also sweet and romantic. It's hard to do. It really pulls it off.
And I think it pulls off this really delicate balancing act by depicting a queer conversion camp as sort of like the silly cartoon thing that you can just sort of brush off.
Well, it gives it no respect whatsoever, yeah, which is key.
And this one, they're treating it, you know, as the monstrous institution it is, but they're turning it into something like horror movie monstrous when it's plenty monstrous the way it is. I said that already.
It sounds like a bad film.
So yeah, they slash them. It kind of sucks. And, you know, setting a slasher at a gay conversion camp, fine idea.
Good idea. That's a good pitch.
Good.
That's one of those things where it's just like, okay, we're going to do a summer camp slasher movie. Seen it. It's at a gay conversion camp. Haven't seen that. Okay. Well, how would we do that? Like, there's like, what interesting commentary can we have there? What a great cast we could have there. What we could play with the genre, which is often dealt with so much with sexual mores. Like, we can... Wow, what a wonderful opportunity. Think of all the different filmmakers who would have done something so interesting and thoughtful and playful and insightful with that. Sounds like it's bad.
Yeah. If we can get anything out of it, it's Theo Germain. They're great.
Okay.
They were in a TV show called, like, The Politicians, and I'm not familiar with that show. But they have movie star quality.
Cool.
They could carry a different movie. They're going to do something, you know. So at the very least, we're introduced to, you know, a new potential movie star.
That's good.
But they slash them is not the movie to propel anybody anywhere.
That's a shame. Well, I saw another movie, and this is another one where the premise is a lot.
Okay.
The premise is whether or not you even want to go past the premise is up to you. But the premise is like, okay, I haven't seen that. I Love My Dad is a film from James Morosini. He wrote, directed it, and stars as a character based on himself. This is based on a true, I don't know how extensively true it is, but apparently the gist of it happened to him and his dad. Mm-hmm. At the beginning of the movie, James Morosini, his father's played by Patton Oswalt. Got a divorce from his mom, and he's been a shitty absentee dad, always calling and making excuses, but never actually being there or doing anything or showing an interest and being present, which is most of the gig. At the end of the credits, we see the toll this has taken on James Morosini's character. The character's name is Franklin, not exactly playing himself, but close. Mm. Franklin is in, he's just done a stint in an institution. Apparently he tried to kill himself. As he leaves, kind of hopeful for the future, socially awkward, but trying to get his life together, he decides the thing to do is to cut his dad out of his life. And he blocks his phone number and he blocks him on social media. His dad figures out that he's been blocked on social media. He might not have been present, but he liked keeping an eye on him that way. Mm. And when he realizes that he's been blocked, he is devastated. And when he very panicky tells his friend, played by Lil Rel Howery, what happened...
I like Lil Rel.
Lil Rel's great. Yeah. He says, well, you know, you could always just start a fake account and just follow him. And Patton Oswalt gets that into his head, but the account that he creates, he decides to basically steal the name and pictures of a waitress at a local diner, creates a new account, uses her real name, and friends his son. And his son accepts the friend request, but seeing that he's her only friend, messages her, and he was going to be anonymous, but now he's like in a position where he says, I'll block you if you don't say anything, I'm going to assume you're a bot. And so he has to talk to his son under the guise of being this attractive young woman.
Oh, no.
And then he starts talking, you know, basically having a conversation with him and showing an interest in him and his hobbies and his life and his feelings. And before long, he's dating his own son. His son doesn't realize it's his dad. And the only way to continue the relationship without breaking his heart is to continue the lie. And eventually he was like, okay, the kid wants to talk to someone on the phone. Patton Oswalt has to come up with some way to convince his girlfriend.
His son. Yeah,
he's catfishing his son.
Right.
And it comes to a real head when the son wants to meet her.
Uh-huh.
And Patton Oswalt agrees to drive him to the town where she lives.
Oh.
And then they're in a motel together. And the kid's like, and again, this kid's like 20 or whatever. Like, he's in his 20s. And like, he's, like, in the bathroom, and he's trying to sext his girlfriend, and Patton Oswalt doesn't know what to do with that, that goes weird. It's a discomfort comedy.
Yeah.
That's what it is. This basically is like, you can imagine if Seinfeld was on today, this is something George Costanza would end up doing.
Yeah.
Like, you know, just like, it's like, I've done something that's, it's very, very selfish of me, but it seemed like a reasonably harmless thing to do at the time, and then it became very harmful, and now the only thing worse than perpetuating the lie is admitting I did the thing in the first place, and... Your mileage on that comedy, on that type of comedy, varies. I'm typically not a fan.
Well, it depends it all on how it's handled.
Exactly. There
are filmmakers who can handle discomfort comedy very well.
Agreed.
And I think the secret to discomfort comedy is assuring the audience. Mm-hmm. That the filmmakers have a point of view on what's going on.
Yeah, the filmmakers are going somewhere with this.
Like,
trust us.
Either they're taking a little bit of vicious glee in it, that's a point of view, or that they clearly don't approve of it, that's a point of view.
Well, again, but you're right.
It doesn't really matter what the point of view is, but it has to be clear.
There's a great movie that is a very uncomfortable comedy, but it's brilliant, that Bobcat Goldthwait directed called World's Greatest Dad.
Yes.
World's Greatest Dads. It was one of the last films that starred Robin Williams. He's great in it. Robin Williams plays a teacher. His son is an asshole.
Just a horrible kid.
His mom
is out of the picture.
So hateful. Just an
misogynistic.
Almost irredeemable.
Learns really bad lessons from pornography. Says those things out loud.
Yeah. The only thing, a
horrible human being.
The only thing redeemable about this kid basically is... his saintly dad loves him. And then...
But he yells at his dad and pushes him around. Like, he hates his own father.
Right. But Robin Williams loves him because it's his son. And that kid dies accidentally, but in a very compromising situation. And Robin Williams decides, in order to save his son's reputation, like, I'm going to at least spare him the indignity of the reality of what happened. He decides that he's going to make it look like the kid killed himself, and he writes a suicide note for his son so that his son will have some respect in death. And it's not the right thing to do, but you can see why he'd do it. But the problem is, he's such a good writer that his son ends up having this like weird legacy. It's almost like Dear Evan Hansen, if Dear Evan Hansen was like really thoughtful and had a point, like a good point. And actually, like, really thought out everything about it. And, like, you see, like, how absolutely uncomfortable this is and how it's preventing him from mourning his son. And all these people who actually hated his son are now pretending that they liked him. And it's really bitter and acidic.
A big part of the movie is he's writing these letters and he himself is a failed writer.
Yeah.
So he is actually using this as an opportunity...
to reach an audience.
Yeah, to boost his own career.
Yeah.
And, you know, and sort of his son is getting all the credit for the writing. He's soaking up all the fame that he's getting by disseminating it.
Yeah, and that's a movie, but Bobcat Goldthwait is a very, very savvy filmmaker, and he knows when that's fucked up. He also knows when it's sympathetic, and he's really able to balance those things really, really well. Like, Robin Williams is doing a terrible thing, but Robin Williams is not an unsympathetic character. That's a tricky balance to pull off in a situation like this. James Morosini is good at getting the discomfort out of the way. But his perspective is weird. It seems to be, judging by the title card at the opening of this movie and the ending of the movie, which I won't give away what happens, but based on the ending, it's not as apocalyptic as it could be. I don't know how much of the story is specifically true. It could be just a thing that happened a little, and then a lot of the really shocking things that happen in the movie are extrapolations in order to turn it into a screenplay. I couldn't say. But as an audience member, I'm watching this, and it is incredibly hard to stay on Patton Oswalt's side. Because he's the protagonist.
Yeah.
He's like the main character here. The whole point is trying to explain why the fuck he did what he did.
Yeah.
It feels by the end of the movie that James Morosini, at least, whether or not his character has come to terms with and still loves his dad.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
A little bit of a redemptive.
Or at least cathartic. But I'm not sure the movie gets us there, is the problem. I think that there's so much discomfort and there's so much emphasis on just how kind of hellish this thing he did was, even if he might have done it for a reason we can wrap our heads around. within the confines of this, what is it, like 2 hour movie? It's an hour and 36 minutes. Mm. Within the confines of this hour and 36 minutes, I feel like I don't reach the conclusion the movie reaches yet.
Okay.
I feel like it doesn't take me there. I am still kind of shocked, fascinated, certainly. There's an interesting movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not entirely sure that the journey it's taken me on, I made it all the way to the end. I think they did, and they told me about it. And as a result, I can't entirely say it's a good film. I can't entirely say it works. But it's too distinctive, and Patton Oswalt's really good in it.
Mm.
I haven't seen a movie quite like this, so credit for that at the very least. I think Patton Oswalt does an exceptional job at making someone doing something unforgivable feel relatively forgivable, but that's not the same as actually getting me to forgive him.
Hmm.
So it's an odd film, and if you want to see an odd film, if you want to see a film that tries to take you some uncomfortable places and knows it's doing it and is trying to get to somewhere with it, whether or not they succeed is up for some debate. Definitely a film to check out, but I don't think it quite works. So on that note, let's review the movies we talked about this week on the critically acclaimed scale.
Just the three.
Just the three. You know what?
Mm.
That's okay. Hmm. We were sick, damn it. We're going to cut ourselves a little bit of slack, and next week we'll do better. The critically acclaimed scale works thusly. We review films on a scale of C- to C+. A C is average. There's some good, there's some bad. It's better for some audiences than others. Most movies probably fall under that umbrella.
Mm.
C- is below average, and that's everything from we just kind of don't recommend it to the worst thing we've ever seen. And C+ is above average. We genuinely recommend it. We might even think it's a classic. On that note, I Love My Dad. I'm going to give it a C.
Okay.
It's too interesting to write off, but I don't think it tells a complete story. I don't think it feels like I don't think it feels like the filmmaker has properly come to terms with everything the audience needs to get out of it.
Okay.
And so it feels a little incomplete.
Got it.
But it's interesting, and I haven't seen the like, so I'll give it some extra bonus points for that. On that note, they/them.
They/them, C-.
Bummer.
This, again, fun, good idea on paper, but they just whiffed everything.
Oh, man. I really wanted to see that. Yeah. It sounds so bad. Like there's a frustrating thing that happens when you're a critic sometime where you're explaining why a movie doesn't work, and people say, oh, that sounds so bad. I really want to see it now. And you're like, no!
No, I'm talking you out of it.
It's not so good. It's not so bad. It's fun. Mm. It's just bad.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
If you need to see any movie with a non-binary protagonist, openly non-binary protagonist, not like played by a non-binary performer, but we're not going to use the word.
You want to support that regardless.
If you want to support that, then yes.
Yeah.
On they/them, but
it's heavily qualified.
Yeah. But it's not good.
All right. And then lastly, Prey.
Prey, I give it a C+. It's a really enjoyable monster movie. I think you're a little higher on it than I am.
Oh, I just love it. I love it to pieces. It's a C+. It's just an excellently crafted monster movie. It's a very, very, very good monster movie. Yeah, and that's enough to be... Some of my favorite movies are just excellently crafted monster movies. It doesn't need to be any more than like that. It's just beautifully done.
There's a previous generation when somebody like Stuart Gordon would have snuck something in like this in like the late 80s. It just would have been played in theaters. No one would have seen it. But then years later, like robot jocks, like guys like us would still be talking about it.
So. Yeah, well, there's a lot of movies that like were only modest successes when they came out, but because of home video and repeat viewings and cult programming and midnight movies, they found that big audience over time, and that's hard to do now.
Yeah.
Because there just aren't as many markets for that. There aren't as many opportunities people just sort of randomly throw into things. So I think Prey is in this interesting sweet spot where, based on the number of people who seem to be talking about it and watching it, it seems reasonably successful for a streamer. But because it's like on a streamer, it still feels like a cult hit.
Yeah.
It's interesting. It's an interesting beast. But yeah, huge old C+. Love it to pieces. That is it for critically acclaimed this week. Next week, we'll be back with reviews of other movies.
I'm seeing a film called, I think it's coming out next week, called Lal Singh Chadha, which is an Indian remake of Forrest Gump.
Oh, I heard about that.
So I'm looking forward to talking about that one.
I don't know about any remake of Forrest Gump. That's really fucking weird. Let's see. I'm probably seeing... I've seen Inuo, the new anime film from Masaaki Iwasa. Yeah. So I'll definitely be reviewing that. There's a new thriller called Fall, which is about people stranded at the top of a very tall thing. There's a new Jamie Foxx vampire movie on Netflix called Day Shift, which just that alone sounds fun, right? Okay.
You got me with the elevator pitch.
Yeah. Right. There's a new James Ponsoldt movie out called Summering.
James Ponsoldt.
Yeah, we'll have to check all these things out. Yeah. So we're very excited about it. We'll have more new releases next week. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. Please subscribe if you haven't already. If you want more exclusive stuff from me and Whitney, you can head on over to patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. We have a lot of exclusive programming over there. We're about to start a new series, Step Me Up, Step Me Down. We're reviewing every single film and episode in the Step Up franchise, of which there is more than maybe you realize. We also have our show, Only the Best. We review every single film ever nominated for Best Picture. We have all our Yesterdays. We review every single episode of Star Trek in order. We do commentary tracks. We do online hangouts. We do trivia nights with our patrons. It's a lot of fun, and it means the world to us, to everyone who subscribes on the Patreon. Thank you. You keep this show afloat. It means everything to us. We wouldn't be here without you. We just wouldn't. If you want to talk about anything we discussed in this episode, we'd love to hear from you. That'd be super cool. You can email us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Mm-hmm. Or if you would prefer, you can send us an actual physical letter on paper or parchment. Whitney, what is our P.O. box?
You can wire us a letter. Actually, I don't think we can accept telegraph.
No, I don't think telegraph exists anymore, actually. Telegrams. I had heard somewhere that like the last telegram had been sent.
That's too bad.
They don't do that anymore.
We don't do telegram. But yeah, if you want to mail us a letter, send it to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yeah, you'll be really, really cool if you did. We love it every single time. And of course, we're on Twitter at Critic Acclaim. I am at William Bibiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibold.
And until next time, never forget, everyone is a critic.
Sorry, what?